Bryce, I can see you hiding back there. Don't ask hard questions. Okay, if you could please close the doors now, so... Okay, before I start talking, please turn off the beeping on your laptops, please turn off your cell phones, and please try not to snore when you're sleeping. Okay. So, this talk is about... Well, not exactly porting SGI failsafe to Linux, but actually more about failsafe's architecture, what features it provides and what it doesn't. So, okay, people keep... Okay. So, if there are any questions in between, please ask the questions. Then I get the illusion that you're actually following and actually awake, and I don't feel too bad about standing here and just talking to myself. So let's start with what failsafe is and more exactly what it is not. Failsafe provides cluster infrastructure services for building high available applications. It provides resource management. It provides high availability by failing over applications. And it has a command line interface or graphical user interface for admins. I can't actually slide the screen, but if someone would adjust the projector. Well, I guess I can't do much about that.
Okay.
Sorry. Well. Well, okay. So where was I? Okay, it provides a user interface and command line interface for administration and monitoring. The graphical interface is kind of a problem because it's written in Java, but you don't have to use it. If you want to use it, it comes with a compatible Java runtime environment because all Java runtime environments are different. I think that's the idea behind Java. What it does not include, and I think that's the real point where I'm doing the slide, it does not include a load balancing solution. You can build that on top of failsafe. It does not include magical data replication. You still need shared storage, however you want to do this, using network mirroring or fiber channel or SCSI. It's not yet another solution for building a web farm. It's not yet another two-node failover solution, like everyone keeps inventing these solutions because everyone needs a product now, and, okay, it's slightly more complex than that. So you can build all these things on top of failsafe, but frankly, failsafe doesn't care much. So let's have a broad look at the architecture and why we choose it. When we were looking... we, as SUSE, were looking for a high availability solution. We were looking for something which the vendor was willing to open source and which they were actually going to open source and survive the open source community. A huge monolithic program isn't exactly the best thing to take into the open source. The good thing about failsafe, however, is that it's pretty modular. So you can go and upgrade single components without having to change the rest of the architecture too much. It also resides completely in user space. A lot of the other high availability solutions require special support from the Windows NT system or from whatever they are running on. Well, in April, we were lucky enough that SGI actually agreed to open source this. It was a kind of rush to get this press release out in time for CeBIT. So actually, I hear the lawyers at SGI were working overtime. I've never heard of a lawyer working overtime, so I'm pretty impressed by that. Unfortunately, the release press release in April forgot to mention the open source date. This is going to be August. It's still going to be August, and it's July now, so I hope it's not going to be much later. They have to go through 350,000 lines of code for proving that it's really all their code and all their intellectual property. It is, so this is going to be a bit quicker and less painful than the XFS. However, at the moment you can already get a binary snapshot in form of RPMs if you email them and ask for it. So it's actually running. It works, sort of. And okay. So the fail-safe architecture looks something like this. It provides chaos. Well, it will provide a lot of chaos for your network, which is basically the cluster infrastructure services, starting with cluster membership services, group communication services, cluster reset services, and system resource manager. We're going through all these in a minute. Then there's the cluster administration services, which is broken down into the cluster administration services, the cluster configuration database, and the user interface, whoever cares about that. Then there's the actual fail-safe module, which resides on that. And then there are agents interfacing to different applications. You have got to write these yourself mostly. So in a graphical view, it looks something like this. At the bottom layer, you have the cluster membership services, on top of which you have the group communication services, which is used by the system resource manager, which is controlled by Failsafe. The system resource manager controls the agents. The cluster membership services talks to the cluster reset services. All of these communicate with the cluster configuration database to get their view of the cluster configuration. And then there is a thing called administration, user interface, whoever. So, okay, let's start with some terminology. First, a node is for failsafe. A node is a single instance of the cluster membership, cluster group communication services. This mostly maps to a single system. However, if you got a system like the S390 broken down into multiple partitions, this single piece of hardware can actually be multiple nodes on your cluster, if you think that's a useful thing to do. So basically, a cluster ends up being a set of nodes. You could have your entire S390 as a single node. I don't know if that's actually useful, but as an entire cluster, but well, you could do that. Then you have a process group, which is a set of processes running in the cluster, communicating with each other via the group communication services. The most fundamental thing for the cluster is the current membership view. This is basically the set of correct nodes for the membership services in a cluster, or the set of correct processes in the group communication services. So the interesting thing, if you're going to run applications on top of this, are basically resources, which is basically everything which you can start, stop, monitor on a node. It's identified by name, various configurable parameters depending on the type of resource, and of course the resource type. A resource type could be IP address, file system, whatever. A resource group defines a set of related resources like IP address, file system, web server, if you have a highly available web server. If you want to do the failover, you define a failover policy, which defines on which node this resource group can be brought online. The failover policy only defines the function by which failsafe determines on which nodes the cluster, the resource group can be brought online at this moment. So you also have a failover domain, which is generated at runtime and which represents a real set of nodes where the resource group can be brought online at this time. The failover policy may think that you could bring the node up on the resource group up on node C in theory, but node C may be down, so the failover domain wouldn't actually include node C. Okay. So the reasoning behind the cluster infrastructure is to isolate a foundation which basically removes code duplication, and on top of which you can build your highly available applications. The current infrastructure provided by Failsafe is architected for up to 60 nodes. The biggest clusters SGI has built using this are 8 nodes. This is not a lot if you think about high-performance computing. But if you're doing failover, having all 8 nodes fail before you actually go down is a hell of a lot. And most of the servers aren't exactly small. I don't know if you know, SGI makes kind of expensive and kind of big boxes, so not many people actually wanted to have thousands of them grouped. So if you want thousands, parts of failsafe have to be upgraded, or we have to wait for Steven. So basically, Chaos unites all the services you need for cluster communication in such an environment. The most fundamental thing about Chaos is the cluster membership services. They basically manage the membership of nodes in the cluster, representing which nodes are currently part of the cluster, whether they are up or down. And this has some interesting properties because it does provide a consistent membership history to all correct nodes. This is kind of complicated because it doesn't actually mean that all the nodes think the cluster is the same at any given moment, because you have asynchronous communication and the cluster is changing all the time. Well, hopefully not, but if the cluster is actually changing, this means that you actually will see all the memberships everyone else has seen in the same order, but you may be 1 second behind or 1/10 of a second behind. So I gave an example. If you got a cluster made of A, B, and C and D join one after another, A and B will both see the clusters ABC and ABCD, but there may be actually a short delay between those two views. And to actually satisfy the property that only a single node can access the shared resources, or only a correct node can access the shared resources, a node which leaves the membership services without giving notice will be stomised, rather killed. So this actually means if you just unplug the power to a node, the membership services will notice and try to make sure that node is really dead. That may have been a bad example, but if you get a kernel crash and the kernel is spinning in an infinite loop or in the kernel debugger, the cluster membership services will notice that it timed out and kill the node. They notice this by exchanging heartbeats over a private Ethernet channel. It's only a private Ethernet at this moment. You can define multiple Ethernet channels. They do not yet support serial line heartbeating or fiber channel heartbeating or infrared heartbeating or whatever you want to do. But it's modular, so you can easily add different types of heartbeats. They are one way only. That means they are not actually acknowledged, which would be kind of stupid. And the cluster membership services also provide an API for the application to access all this information, to query node status, to evict the node from the cluster. You can actually ask that your node leaves the cluster. So this is basically the most important points about the membership service. Are there any questions regarding this? Because it's, yes?
Does it say the Ethernet, doesn't it provide the same point of failure if your power failure hub crashes?
Well, you can have multiple private Ethernet channels. And just to make the point, they are meant to be private because...
Crossover
cables or dedicated switch, whatever. Because failsafe is actually exchanging control messages over the same network. And if you can access the control messages, you could actually ask failsafe to reset a node. This may be considered a denial of service attack. So if your entire node suddenly goes down, but most real solutions have this problem. It's pretty difficult to solve, but it's modular, and we are looking for someone to solve this. On top of this, you have the group communication services. They provide for process membership and messaging inside the cluster. So you would have the system resource manager running on all nodes actually joins the process group of the system resource manager and they communicate over the group communication services. Now, this has some interesting properties. First, it's reliable. This can be broken down into three further requirements, which basically means that if you receive a message, you can be sure that all other nodes receive that message too, as long as they are correct. It also means that only a message broadcasted by a correct process will actually be delivered, and only once. There are supposed to be no duplicates. And they are also ordered. That means if one node receives message 1 before message 2, all other nodes will receive message 1 before message 2. This is kind of important when you are doing a recovery. And it also provides a slightly more complicated property, which is called by SGI virtual synchrony. That means that all processes in a group membership receive the same messages, and that every message is delivered in the view in which it was sent. So if you have a process A and B in the process group, and A is sending a message, and process C joins the cluster, the group, this node will not see that message. And group communication services is also one of the more fundamental services of failsafe and chaos. So if group communication services crash on a node and become unavailable, the node will actually be evicted from the cluster when the cluster communication services cannot be restarted. Okay. Well, the reset basically happens over the cluster reset services, which is just a fancy way to kill the power to a different node. But it's in a different module of failsafe to make sure you can add multiple ways to kill the, to actually kill off the node. You could do this by literally telling the power system to shut down via X10 or programmable power cords. Some Intel boards have programmable power over the serial port, operator intervention. You could actually have a process asking an administrator, go and shut down that node and acknowledge that you shut down the node. This is probably one of the more simple things, but it kind of makes automatic failover difficult. You could also have the cluster reset services actually not reset the node, but cut it off from the shared storage by instructing your fiber channel fabric to not allow access by that node or via SCSI reservation. The important point about the cluster reset services is that you have to find a way to reset the node which is actually acknowledged. So you have to read back the status of the network or of the power network and find out if the node is really dead, because as long as you don't know it's really dead, you can't rely on it being really dead. And this is all about paranoia, so you have to acknowledge that. Okay, now we're getting to the more interesting parts of this, at least if you're going to use it. Those were pretty interesting when you're going to program failsafe applications yourself, but most of you just want to run, I guess most of you just want to run applications on your clusters, so you have to interact with the system resource manager. First, the system resource manager is actually a process group in your entire cluster using the group communication services. SRM manages the ownership database. That means the system resource manager knows which nodes are running a specific resource. And if a node goes down, it will SRM gets notified by the chaos layer and receives the acknowledgement that that node has been reset and says, okay, this resource is available again. It's responsible for starting and stopping and monitoring resources on the local node. So that means it basically interacts with the application. Hey, are you running? Please start now. Please start. Please. And stopping the application. This is kind of related to a boot up script or startup script with System 5 boot up scripts. Except you're supposed to be more careful about what you're actually doing. If the system resource manager asks you to stop an application, you aren't only supposed to check whether there's a file with a process ID on the disk and whether that process is actually running. You're supposed to check that this process is really dead, that there's no other process running, and that this information is correct, because otherwise you're providing false information to the failover system, and, well, all bets are off. It will also attempt a local restart of the application before moving the resource group to a different cluster. This is kind of important because moving a resource group may involve stopping Oracle, unmounting a huge file system, remounting the huge file system on a different node, restarting Oracle, and that all because a single web server failed because of a bug in a CGI script or whatever. That's usually not what you want. Oh, wow. You should be asking more questions. You aren't listening. Okay, now an example for a resource would be the resource type IP address.
Mark?
Yes?
So how long does that take to do a local restart versus a start carrying out on the node?
Yes.
Assuming that the app startup is like very small.
If the app startup is like very small, it takes as long. Okay, it depends on how you configure failsafe to monitor your application. If you tell it to monitor your application every 10 seconds, it will notice after 10 seconds. Since it's a local restart, it should not have to consult the rest of the cluster. That should mean that it's online after a few seconds. If, however, the application takes a long time to restart, or if it can't actually restart the application, it really depends on the application. That would mean stopping all other resources in the resource group, however that long would take. Then failsafe would have to find another node to run the application on. This may take a few, should be pretty quick. And then actually start up all the resources on that node, however that long would take. And, well, mostly depends on the time the application needs to start. I think you can configure a delay so you don't end up restarting your application all 10 seconds, which is kind of killing the performance of most clusters. But that's mostly application specific. Yes?
The atomic messaging you mentioned, would that be used by the applications to make sure transactions got into everybody's database?
Okay. Let's go back to this. Failsafe provides a cluster infrastructure for the application to use. Whether the application is actually using this to communicate is a whole different story. Yes.
But it can.
It can. It's exported to user space via an API, and the group communication services actually are all about processes communicating with each other. So you could have all your web servers in a process group communicating, like deciding where to actually answer the request. Honestly, I have no idea how performant this group communication services is. I'm not entirely sure. I think the group communication services are not that bad. The cluster membership services are, at least from what I understood of the membership protocol, leave some room for improvement. On the other hand, the real point here is that it's, well, basically, even if it leaves room for improvement, failsafe is actually running in pretty big installations. So it's not like, here's yet another new product, but it's more like, here's another product on the market for 5 years for Linux. So even though it can be improved, it's basically to the point where it works. Okay, where was... Oh, I'm a bit too fast. Okay. Any other questions so far? Okay. If I'm not seeing you, just... Yes?
Is there any way we can approach to get some sort of timing measurements and throughput measurements on this system?
Well, yes, you can email the address I showed and will show again and ask for a binary snapshot for now or the open source release in August. And then you can run those performance measurements yourself. I have actually no idea. I think they are mostly concerned about fail-safe working than about performance. If the application needs a high bandwidth communication channel, I'm pretty sure the group communication services aren't the right thing, but mostly it's about exchanging synchronization information. Like, I have reached state B. Have you all reached state B? For implementing barrier services or things like that. And you would exchange the actual data over some other channel, because otherwise you're going to hog your private link. Okay. Yes?
Do you have any picture about how the nodes are being connected? How the nodes are being connected?
The nodes are being connected over a private Ethernet, and how you connect them to the outside world is basically up to you.
How about the hard drive?
That's... Yes, it's exactly. It's just a resource. What you actually do is completely up to the application. Failsafe, frankly, doesn't care whether your resource is starting is mounting a file system from some sort of shared fiber channel array, or whether it's actually starting a picture viewer displaying presentations. If you want to have a highly available presentation, so you could do that with Failsafe. Failsafe doesn't care. It's just Failsafe manages the resources. Ask the resource for status, and how you connect the nodes is entirely different problem. This, yes? You probably could substitute a wide area network. The problem is that they are running all the cluster membership and the membership protocol over this. So if you're running like an 8-node cluster, I think they actually, when they actually need this to agree on a new membership view, they are sort of saturating the Ethernet, so for a short amount of time, because they are exchanging a whole lot of messages and a whole lot more of data. Like I said, the membership protocol actually leaves a lot of room for improvement, and if you know the program called Heartbeat, which has a really, really, really frightening resource management. It was actually meant to be a design study for a Heartbeat protocol. And for the cases where you could use Failsafe, you could actually make good use of this module. And there we are actually looking at exchanging the membership services. But at this moment, we are more concerned with actually getting the code out. And all upgrades come after that. Well, yes?
Did you notice the algorithm for how your ensuring messages are delivered in order and to all nodes?
This is an evil question. actually, I can't offhand because I didn't write it. That's a good thing. I didn't have to think too much about it because someone else already wrote the code and they just noted it works. So basically, all I remember is that it's basically a two-phase membership protocol and that the documents at that point in time were tagged SGI proprietary, so I didn't actually get to read them. So now I have the code, and I could deduce the algorithm from the code, but I think I'm waiting until I can get at the documentation. Sorry, I can't answer that question. I guess so. I actually saw a... Actually, the code is very, very nice. It includes a whole lot of comments, actually documenting not what the code does, but what the algorithm is supposed to do. And the membership services actually include a whole lot of comments because the first comment in the file says, you better read all the comments and try to understand how clusters work before you even look at this code. So I didn't because I don't. So, okay. Yes?
How does it compare to other clustering, like
Okay, just the questions up to now, because I still have a few slides left. So, what's your question? Does it pertain to what I already said, or? Okay, so a typical resource would be an IP address, which would be associated with an interface, obviously the IP address itself and the netmask. A file system is typically identified by a device where you mount it from, a mount point, and a file system type. Those small configurations would probably be actually stored in the cluster configuration database. I'm getting to that. The more complex configurations, like how you are configuring your web server, you would probably just store a profile name in the database and then start Apache with the correct configuration file. Otherwise, you're blowing up the configuration database, and since the configuration database is actually a fairly complex piece of code, which is like one-third to two-third of the design documentation actually only talk about how the algorithms in the cluster configuration database work. First, it consists of a front end, which provides a client view of the cluster database, so you don't have to actually care about how it's implemented, which is good because it's kind of scary. This is used by the command line configuration interface or even by the Java user interface, if you want to use the Java user interface. The database is replicated across all nodes, obviously, because all nodes need a consistent view of how they are supposed to be working. Otherwise, well, just won't work. The data is stored in a simple key-value combination. Basically, it's a replicated DBM file, whatever. It's sort of more complex than that, but it's easier to think of that. They said they did that because they had no idea what kind of information the applications would actually want to store in there. So you can just store your information in a flat namespace and introduce hierarchies by using dots or underscores. They're mostly using underscores and storing arbitrary data in the database. What's important is that it's actually providing transactional semantics. So if you're defining a resource like an IP address, you don't end up with an interface set and an IP address set, but the netmask didn't make it into the database. This would be kind of annoying because you might end up setting the netmask to /0 and using that interface as your default route or whatever. Or like mounting the file system with the wrong type, and the file system may try to be smart and actually convert the file system to another format, or try running fcheck on it, and basically fucking you all over. So basically you can provide transactional semantics, which means you can create a block in a single operation, or you can commit a set of updates as one transaction, and either you get the full update or no update at all. This also makes user interfaces kind of easy, because you just collect all the data, commit it to the database, and it either works or not. This is also exported to the user space, so if you have sort of a distributed application running on your cluster, you can manage the configuration for that using this database. It will provide you with a notification if someone is changing your configuration, so you can read the new configuration from the database and update yourself, and tell everyone else via those famous group communication services that you updated your configuration and are now running like you're supposed to. Now, the name of this product, as you already noticed, there's more to this than just failsafe, but in failsafe, there's actually a module called failsafe, just to confuse you, which basically implements the policy. The system resource manager manages resources. The system resource manager does not manage resource groups or does not decide where to move the application in case of failure. Failsafe basically sets a policy for your cluster. Here's some examples of what it can do. It can decide to move an application and the entire resource group to a different node when a new node comes up. Like node B failed, you moved all the applications to node A, and node B comes back up again. Do you move the resource group back to node B, or do the resources stay on node A? This is one of the decisions which Failsafe makes. You can also have priorities for resource groups. If you have a web server and Oracle running as a resource group, and the web server fails, maybe the web server is part of the resource group and should always reside on the same system. But just because the administrative web server failed, you may not want to move your entire Oracle database and cause downtime for the, for your entire organization. So you can say, okay, this resource group is not so important. If it fails, notify me, but don't actually move the web server to another the database to another node. However, if the database would fail, it would move the database, the file system, and the web server to a different node, because the web the database has the highest priority in the group. So basically, Failsafe interacts with the system resource managers in the network, in the cluster, and the cluster configuration database, where all of this is defined. Of course, it also manages the failover policies. It determines which nodes are actually usable for this resource group at this point in time. So the thing you're going to work with when you are going to add a new resource, like you want to add your Oracle database into the system, you will have to write a few scripts. Some scripts are provided with Failsafe, like IP address takeover, because it's a very basic example, or template script from which you can start. So for each resource, you have a set of user-definable parameters, as I said, IP address, netmask, interface, for example, which is stored in the cluster configuration database. And this gets passed to the respective scripts. The system resource manager has no idea whether you're running a database or an IP address. It's just interacting with these scripts. You have a start script, which, very surprisingly, is supposed to start the resource on that node with that configuration. You have a stop script, which, very surprisingly, is supposed to stop the application on that node. You have a restart script, which, very surprisingly, is supposed to restart the application on that node. And you have a monitor script, which monitors whether the application is actually running correctly. This is supposed to be a lightweight check. With a web server, you could just try to request a document from the web server and see if it is replying. This is run at configurable intervals to determine whether the application is still there, rather the resource is still there. And since it's run fairly often, it's supposed to be a lightweight check. So if you have a more expensive check, like you're running ping statistics on your network interface to see if you actually can use this network interface to host this IP address, you would be running a daemon, an other agent, which actually continuously runs the statistics, and the script would just ask the daemon for the result. I'm not sure what happens when these scripts block. They have a timeout, but basically, as long as this script is running, the system resource manager is kind of blocked because it has to, in one way or the other, wait for the return. Yes?
Can you just monitor availability, or can you monitor the performance of the application?
That's actually up to your application. If you want to monitor availability, you can do that, but if you want to do performance monitoring, you would probably be running a daemon continuously collecting data. And if it suddenly gets worse, your monitor script may reply with, okay, this performance is too bad, this application isn't running correctly on this node. So what you actually do is entirely up to you. Yes?
Yeah, but wouldn't it be just that the monitor script is supposed to give the resource manager a quick answer, yes or no, this resource is...
Yes, exactly. That's what the monitor script is supposed to be doing. How it arrives at the conclusion that the monitor script, that the application is running, failsafe actually doesn't care. You could write a monitor script which always returns, I'm running. This is kind of stupid, but you could do that. You can also tell failsafe to temporarily ignore that the monitor script is giving a negative result, because if you're upgrading a single component of your system, you know that you're doing that, and you don't want failsafe to move the resource group. You may be doing this in a way which does not affect the rest of the resource group, and since you're the administrator, you don't want to cause downtime by being the administrator, which is actually the main reason why downtime happens, but still. Another script would be the probe script, which is run by failsafe to determine whether it could actually run the resource. That's actually, if probe says it's running, gives back a positive result. The failsafe will mark this resource as online ready. That means it could be brought online if it hasn't been brought online before. Yes? You could do that, of course, but as I said, this is policy. The administrator can do that, but he does not have to do that.
So he doesn't have to do it, okay?
Yes, it would be smarter to do that.
Right, but failsafe would allow that, I guess my point.
Well, obviously you can upgrade a system which isn't running the application. That would mean, okay, yes, you could tell failsafe to not move the resource to this node for that time. Now the exclusive script is sounds suspiciously similar to the monitor script because it basically checks whether the resource is running on that node. However, it does not check. It's not supposed to check whether it's running correctly. It's just supposed to be checking whether some part of the resource is running on that system. This is a bit difficult to explain, I think, or rather not, I hope not. It can be more intrusive than the monitor check. It could run through the process list and check whether there's any process associated with that resource or whatever. This is run by failsafe at startup time or when you query, when a node joins a cluster. It will run exclusive scripts for the resources to determine whether they are running on that system to ensure that only one node is accessing the shared resources. Well, that's why it's called exclusive, to ensure exclusive access to the resources. I hope this is sort of clear. Okay, this was a quick talk. I'm very happy. I'm way in time. So now we have a lot of time for questions. That's why, yes?
I'm assuming there's some sort of logging facility. Is there a way to, from the log, get a measurement of availability? Suppose you want to post-process measurement?
Yes, failsafe, of course, failsafe logs updates to the configuration or failover. However, how you process a log file data, they are plain text. I can just show you the user interface. And as you can see, it's really kind of slow. So, okay. So here you have an overview of the configuration interface, which is basically the same you can see with the command line interface, but the command line interface isn't as shiny, for varying definitions of shiny. You can define a node, you can add remove nodes, you can ask the cluster reset service to actually reset a node, you can modify the node, whatever, the usual stuff you would expect. You can group a group of nodes to a cluster, modify the cluster or delete the cluster. You have resources which you can define, or you can define an entire new resource type for your web server. You can define the failover policies, like ordered, which would mean that it's running on, if you define the failover domain to be A, B, C, and you're running it with an ordered failover policy, you would be, I don't have a cluster defined because I only have a single node. This is, I can't actually demonstrate most of the features then. But for a demonstration, you could also define a round robin failover policy, which would mean that every time failsafe asks a service, it would start on a different node, round robin, which is not really useful for day-to-day operation, but it kind of demonstrates that it's actually working. You can define the resource group, which also defines the dependencies between the resources. Normally, you want the IP address to be brought online before you start the web server, because otherwise the web server may not start. You can suspend to monitor resource group, like I said, in case you... Does the cursor show on the screen? Okay. In case you are upgrading that resource group. And you can, of course, bring the resource group online after you've defined it and tell failsafe, okay, take the resource group offline, I don't need it anymore. And you can run diagnostics, which would, for example, the test resources would run all the probe scripts for the resource group and come back with a result, okay, this resource is defined correctly on all nodes, whatever. And you can easily crash this, I think, because it's Java. There's also guided configuration here, which basically tells you which steps you have to do in what order, and it will not allow you to do them in a different order. This may seem stupid and sort of like it's an application interfering with the almighty root, but if you think about the fact that most failures happen because the administrator is kind of drunk or whatever, it's actually a pretty useful thing. And high availability, frankly, doesn't care whether you think you're right or you're not. It cares about whether you're right when you do something. And it sort of helps if you shield a stupid user from their own stupidity. So this is not a very popular view, I know. But as I have to agree with Miguel here, if you allow the user to fuck up, he will, and he will not blame himself because he's a pointy head boss. He will blame the application. And since this is really about giving the user the illusion that the application is highly available, this is probably the right thing to do. Now, one thing about the politics here. I said yet another web farm. We kind of have to come back to this question. We kind of have a gazillion different products doing two-node failover, most based on some sort of either of some available heartbeat algorithm, which is kind of nice, or yet another invention to do two-node failover. I personally think this is kind of stupid, really, really, really stupid, because everyone keeps reinventing the same wheel. They look at a specific kind of product and come back saying, oh my God, this can't do just what I wanted to do. I'm going to write my own instead of kind of adding an additional feature or two or bug fixing it. We're seeing a vast fragmentation in the HA market right now. I'm not going to actually compare the different solutions. I mean, there's VA's UltraMonkey, there's Red Hat's Piranha, Kimberlite from Mission Critical Linux, Turbo Linux, Turbo Cluster. Two-node failover solution is available by Legato too. Siemens RCF. Did I forget about something? SteelEye, LifeKeeper, then there's Bluetail doing it in Erlang, a totally different language. And if I think about it a little bit longer, I will probably come up with even more. What? Yes. Well, yeah, that's included in VA's UltraMonkey. They use Heartbeat, so yeah, okay, we have sort of Heartbeat too. And actually, I think this is really, really bad because everyone is running off in different directions. Running off in different directions is fine if you're actually running in different directions to explore new possibilities. But the problem is everyone keeps reinventing the same wheel. And strangely, they all provide the same features. Most of them, if they are doing web server load balancing, are based on the Linux virtual server, which is nice because it actually means they are reusing some code and not reinventing that themselves. On the other hand, if you look at Linux Turbo Cluster, they actually reinvented the Linux virtual server in a way which I personally think lacks a few very important features and doesn't scale as well and whatever. PolySurf Understudy is another one of those for two-node failover. It's like developers in the open source community aren't actually looking at what's available to them in the open source community, but they just want to throw out code to the open source community that they can say they are participating. This is hopefully not what we are going to do with Failsafe. Well, on one hand, of course, it is what we are doing with Failsafe. but we hope that Failsafe actually provides the infrastructure and the modular design to at least reunite some of those tasks. I mean, there's really no need why you should have 20 different solutions for failover. If they would provide different features, that would be fine, or if they would be aimed at different markets, but they aren't. They all aim at shared data two-node clusters, and nobody can decide on one. There's a thing about we need to have a product press release with our own product out now, paranoia going on. The press release paranoia.
Yeah.
No, actually, we don't have this paranoia. Otherwise, we would have put out our own load balancing solution. And actually, some of the managers think we should have done that, but luckily, we could prevent that from happening because we are kind of busy with this Failsafe stuff. Because basically, Failsafe is not yet another independently developed solution. It's been tested, it works, and it even provides a platform for further development to happen. This, if Stephen is in the audience, I can't see him, this is good, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to answer the questions. Thank you for not asking any questions. I read Stephen's design documents, and they are really cool, and I talked to Stephen at, well, a few conferences about his clustering ideas, and they are really, really cool. And I really think more power to him. And if we really get a few hundred thousand nodes on an intercontinental corporate backbone, which is kind of a nice sentence, that's why I remembered it, this is not what Failsafe can do. It probably never will. I don't think the architecture itself would scale to this. It will probably scale to 64 nodes if you fix some of the design issues. It will probably be able to be secure if you fix the issues with the private Ethernet and use some encrypted channel over a public Ethernet. However, Failsafe has a distinct advantage of being ready, which is kind of nice. So I do hope that we can at least get rid of everything, well, unite what's already out there. Of course, if we really get the cool stuff, I'm all for changing to that. But at the moment, it's more about gaining experience with what high availability is all about, because most people don't quite understand. I'm not sure whether I understand it. So, okay. Questions? Let's start at the back. Well, I could, but then I would have, like, the U.S. government on my back, because SGI is selling mainly to them and large database installations. And one of the main problems is actually giving references to your big customers is that they don't want anybody to know what they're running on the infrastructure. I'm pretty sure most of the people running and having big customers can relate to that. It's nice when they allow you to talk about it, but since I didn't ask specifically for this talk, I just can't quote them. Sorry.
The guaranteed message delivery in order,
yes.
Is that for the payload messaging or just
Basically, the maintenance messaging is using the same group communication services that the application can use.
It's available to the application.
It's available to the application. That's the entire point of this. Yes.
I'm having trouble delivering A. Is there a time mode mechanism saying, all right, discard A because I can't deliver within a millisecond?
It does not mean that you are if you're sending A, B, C, and A doesn't get through, for one, this is not supposed to be happening. Well, I do think there's some timeout available. But it just means that if you receive the messages in ABC, all other nodes will receive the same messages. This is sort of slightly different.
I'm thinking from the sender's perspective, I'm trying to
broadcast. If the message was acknowledged, it will have been sent. So basically, you have a configurable timeout for this. If it's not acknowledged, it has not been sent, it has not been received. And yes, and if it has been received, all nodes will have received it. Okay.
You mentioned that at some point in the process you can periodically saturate an Ethernet, 10 megabit, 100 megabits.
I'm not actually sure. I didn't manage to saturate it with the 2-3 node clusters we have available, and I didn't actually pay too much attention to that. It's just that they say that is one of the design limitations of the algorithm, as the code says so, and it has some sort of very bad runtime, which is like scales to 2 to the power of number of nodes or something like that. This is for the amount of messages exchanged to actually agree on a new membership, so it doesn't scale very well, and they basically limited the maximum number of nodes to 16 by using a 16-bit wide bit field in the messaging protocol. This can be fixed because the application doesn't see the actual binary packets on the net. So,
could you redisplay your last slide with the URL?
Of course. What?
What coexists with other flavors?
That's an interesting question. Basically, Failsafe has only been ported to IRIX because it was written on IRIX, and it has been ported to Linux. So we will see when you actually run it on a different flavor of Unix. Left as an exercise to the reader. But what I found kind of scary was when I gave the first presentations about this to big customers, the only thing they asked about was, will you provide a journaling file system for the S390 and will you be porting Failsafe to the S390? Which was like the first question after the talk, and it was like, yes, of course. So I hope it will run on most architectures in the end. At the moment, it's developed on Intel. Yes?
So does that mean
you can have this has not been tested, left as an exercise for the reader. Frankly, I think most people don't actually want to run such clusters. Come to think about this, I do think that SGI will take care of that because they will provide a smooth upgrade path for the existing customers. At least I hope they will. It would make a lot of sense. Yes?
I work for SGI, and I actually do the global product support for Failsafe.
Yes? Perfect. Okay.
Are there kernel hooks that Failsafe needs? I saw that, but I'm just wondering if there's any, because there might not be explicit hooks in the sense of a function call or a system call, but there might be behaviors that it expects back from the kernel.
Well, it basically expects the kernel to be utterly bug free. Sort of.
Those are sort of implicit behaviors that we sort of anticipate in the
Well, I do think they will probably expect your system to adhere to some sort of POSIX standard. But group communication services, I think, actually requires a message to be acknowledged. So this sort of implies it has been sent. Yes?
I guess to phrase that differently, was it difficult to port to Linux?
It was difficult to get all the SGI proprietary makefiles out of the code, I think. I think that was actually one of the main problems with porting FailSafe. To automate and packaging everything as an RPM and testing it, and we did lots of the documentation work, and as far as I can tell, that wasn't actually the big problem. The big problem or the big delay in this is actually testing it and the legal crap. Any other questions or coffee? Yes?
You said open source. Is it GPL?
It will be GPL. It will be, actually, it will be a combination of GPL and LGPL because it also includes libraries. Obviously, we want to provide a common foundation for the independent software vendors to build their high availability applications and for them to be allowed to link with the libraries. We have to use LGPL. But yes, it will be a combination of GPL and LGPL.
When?
August. So there's some sort of big Linux conference in August somewhere in California, which may or may not be a good day to announce such a release. I hope so, at least. I actually have most of the code already has the GPL headers in, so there are just small parts left and the final seal of approval before it can be released. Maybe even before August. That would be even better. Questions? I need to read my email. Okay.